That's impossible. Zhuchka's non-existent. Zhuchka's lost in the mists of obscurity. Ah, couldn't we do this? Smurov suddenly stood still. You see, Ilusha says that Zhuchka was a shaggy, greyish, smoky-looking dog like Perezvon. Couldn't you tell him this is Zhuchka and he might believe you? Boy, shun a lie, that's one thing. Even with a good object, that's another. Above all, I hope you've not told them anything about my coming. Heaven forbid, I know what I'm about. But you won't comfort him with Perezvon, said Smurov with a sigh. You know, his father, the captain, the Wisp of Tow, told us that he was going to bring him a real mastiff pup with a black nose today. He thinks that would comfort Ilusha, but I doubt it. And how is Ilusha? Oh, he's bad, very bad. I believe he's in consumption. He's quite conscious, but he's breathing. His breathing's gone wrong. The other day he asked to have his boots on to be led round the room. He tried to walk, but he couldn't stand. Ah, I told you before, father, he said, that those boots were no good. I could never walk properly in them. He fancied it was his boots that made him stagger, but it was simply weakness, really. He won't live another week. Hertz and Stuber is looking after him. Now they're rich again. They've got heaps of money. They're rogues. Who are rogues? Doctors and the whole crew of quacks collectively, and also, of course, individually. I don't believe in medicine. It's a useless institution. I mean to go into all that. But what's that sentimentality you've got up there? The whole class seems to be there every day. Not the whole class. It's only 10 of our fellows who go to see him every day. There's nothing in that. What I don't understand in all this is the part that Alexei Karamazov is taking in it. His brother's going to be tried tomorrow or next day for such a crime, and yet he has so much time to spend on sentimentality with boys. There's no sentimentality about it. You're going yourself now to make it up with Ilusha. Make it up with him? What an absurd expression. But I allow no one to analyze my actions. And how pleased Ilusha will be to see you. He has no idea that you're coming. Why was it? Why was it you wouldn't come all this time? Smurov cried with sudden warmth. My dear boy, that's my business, not yours. I'm going of myself because I choose to, but you've all been hauled there by Alexei Karamazov. There's a difference, you know. And how do you know? I may not be going to make it up at all. It's a stupid expression. It's not Karamazov at all. It's not his doing. Our fellows began going there of themselves. Of course, they went with Karamazov at first. And there's been nothing of that sort. No silliness. First one went and then another. His father was awfully pleased to see us. You know he'll simply go out of his mind if Ilusha dies. He sees that Ilusha's dying. And he seems so glad we've made it up with Ilusha. Ilusha asked after you, that was all. He just asks and says no more. His father will go out of his mind or hang himself. He behaved like a madman before. You know he is a very decent man. We made a mistake then. It's all the fault of that murderer who beat him then. Karamazov's a riddle to me all the same. I might have made his acquaintance long ago, but I like to have a proper pride in some cases. Besides, I have a theory about him, which I must work out and verify. Kolya subsided into dignified silence. Smurov, too, was silent. Smurov, of course, worshipped Krasotkin and never dreamed of putting himself on a level with him. Now he was tremendously interested at Kolya's saying that he was going of himself to see Ilusha. He felt that there must be some mystery in Kolya's suddenly taking it into his head to go to him that day. They crossed the marketplace, in which at that hour many loaded wagons from the country, and a great number of live fowls. The market women were selling rolls, cottons and threads, etc., in their booths. These Sunday markets were naively called fairs in the town, and there were many such fairs in the year. Perezvon ran about in the wildest spirits, sniffing about first one side then the other. When he met other dogs, they zealously smelt each other over according to the rules of canine etiquette. "I like to watch such realistic scenes, Smurov," said Kolya suddenly. "Have you noticed how dogs sniff at one another when they meet? Seems to be a law of their nature." "Yes, it's a funny habit." "No, it's not funny. You're wrong there. There's nothing funny in nature. however funny it may seem to man with his prejudices. If dogs could reason and criticize us, they'd be sure to find just as much that would be funny to them, if not far more, in the social relations of men, their masters. Far more, indeed. I repeat that because I'm convinced that there is far more foolishness amongst us. That's Rakitin's idea, a remarkable idea. I am a socialist, Smurov.
And what is a socialist?
Asked Smurov. That's when all are equal and all have property in common. There are no marriages and everyone has any religion and laws he likes best, and all the rest of it. You're not old enough to understand yet. It's cold, though.
Yes, 12 degrees of frost. Father looked at the thermometer just now.
Have you noticed, Smurov, that in the middle of winter we don't feel so cold, even when there are 15 or 18 degrees of frost, as we do now in the beginning of winter, when there is a sudden frost of 12 degrees, especially when there's not much snow? It's because people are not used to it. Everything is habit with men, everything, even in their social and political relations. Habit is the great motive power. What a funny-looking peasant!
Kolya pointed to a tall peasant, with a good-natured countenance, in a long sheepskin coat, who was standing by his wagon, clapping together his hands in their shapeless leather gloves to warm them. His long, fair beard was all white with frost.
"That peasant's beard's frozen,"
Kolya cried in a loud, provocative voice as he passed him.
"Lots of people's beards are frozen," the peasant replied calmly and sententiously.
"Don't provoke him," observed Smurov. "It's all right, he won't be cross, he's a nice fella. Goodbye, Matvey."
"Goodbye."
"Is your name Matvey?"
"Yes, didn't you know?"
"No, I didn't, it was a guess."
"You don't say so. You're a schoolboy, I suppose."
"Yes."
"You get whipped, I expect."
"Nothing to speak of, sometimes."
"Does it hurt?"
"Well, yes, it does."
"Eh, what a life!"
The peasant heaved a sigh from the bottom of his heart.
"Goodbye, Matvey."
"Goodbye. You're a nice chap, that you are."
The boys went on.
"That was a nice peasant," Kolya observed to Smurov. "I like talking to the peasants, and I'm always glad to do them justice." "Why did you tell a lie pretending we're thrashed?" asked Smurov. "I had to say that to please him." "How do you mean?"
"You know, Smurov, I don't like being asked the same thing twice. I like people to understand, at the first word, some things can't be explained. According to a peasant's notions, schoolboys are whipped and must be whipped. What would a schoolboy be if he were not whipped? And if I were to tell him we're not, he'd be disappointed. But you don't understand that. One has to know how to talk to the peasants."
"Only don't tease them, please, or you'll get into another scrape as you did about that goose."
"So you're afraid?"
"Don't laugh, Kolya. Of course I'm afraid. My father would be awfully cross. I'm strictly forbidden to go out with you."
"Don't be uneasy. Nothing will happen this time. Hello, Natasha," he shouted to a market woman in one of the booths. "Call me Natasha. What next? My name is Maria," the middle-aged market woman shouted at him. "I'm so glad it's Maria. Goodbye." "Ah, you young rascal. A brat like you to carry on so.
I'm in a hurry, I can't stay now. You shall tell me next Sunday."
Kolya waved his hand at her, as though she had attacked him and not he her.
"I've nothing to tell you next Sunday. You set upon me, you impotent young monkey. I didn't say anything," bawled Maria. "You want a whipping, that's what you want, you saucy jackanapes."
There was a roar of laughter among the other market women round her. Suddenly a man in a violent rage darted out from the arcade of shops close by. He was a young man, not a native of the town, with dark, curly hair and a long, pale face, marked with smallpox. He wore a long blue coat and a peaked cap, and looked like a merchant's clerk. He was in a state of stupid excitement and brandished his fist at Kolya.
"I know you," he cried angrily. "I know you."
Kolya stared at him. He could not recall when he could have had a row with the man, but he'd been in so many rows in the street that he could hardly remember them all.
"Do you?"
he asked sarcastically.
"I know you. I know you," the man repeated idiotically.
"So much the better for you. Well, it's time I was going. Goodbye."
"You're at your saucy pranks again," cried the man. "You're at your saucy pranks again. I know. You're at it again."
"It's not your business, brother, if I am at my saucy pranks again,"
said Kolya, standing still and scanning him.
"Not my business."
"No, it's not your business."
"Who's then? Who's then? Who's then?"
"It's Trifon Nikitich's business, not yours."
"What Trifon Nikitich?"
asked the youth, staring with loutish amazement at Kolya, but still angry as ever. "Have you been to the Church of the Ascension?" he suddenly asked him with stern emphasis.
"What Church of Ascension? What for? No, I haven't," said the young man, somewhat taken aback.
"Do you know Sabaneyev?" Kolya went on even more emphatically and even more severely.
"What Sabaneyev? No, I don't know him."
"Well, then you can go to the devil," said Kolya, cutting short the conversation, and turning sharply to the right he strode quickly on his way, as though he disdained further conversation with adults who did not even know Sabaneyev.
"Stop! Hey! What Sabaneyev?"
The young man recovered from his momentary stupefaction, and was as excited as before.
"What did he say?"
He turned to the market women with a silly stare. The women laughed. "You can never tell what he's after," said one of them.
"What Sabaneyev is he talking about?"
the young man repeated, still furious and brandishing his right arm.
"It must be a Sabaneyev who worked for the Kuzmichovs, that's who it must be," one of the women suggested.
The young man stared at her wildly.
"For the Kuzmichovs?" repeated another woman. "But his name wasn't Trifon, his name's Kuzma, not Trifon. But the boy said Trifon Nikitich, so he can't be the same."
"His name is not Triton and not Sabaneyev.
It's Chizhov,"
put in suddenly a third woman who had hitherto been silent, listening gravely.
"Alexei Ivanich is his name. Chizhov. Alexei Ivanich."
"Not a doubt about it, it's Chizhov,"
a fourth woman emphatically confirmed the statement. The bewildered youth gazed from one to another.
"But what do you ask for? What do you ask for, good people?"
he cried, almost in desperation.
"Do you know Sabaneyev?"
says he.
"And who the devil's to know who is Sabaneyev?"
"You're a senseless fellow, I tell you. It's not Sabaneyev, but Chizhov. Alexei Ivanich Chizhov, that's who it is,"
one of the women shouted at him impressively.
"What Chizhov? Who is he? Tell me if you know."
"That tall, snivelling fellow who used to sit in the market in the summer."
"And what's your Chizhov to do with me, good people, eh?"
"How can I tell what he's to do with you?"
put in another. "You ought to know yourself what you want with him, if you make such a clamour about him.
He spoke to you, he did not speak to us, you stupid.
Don't you really know him?"
"Know whom?"
"Chizhov.
The devil take Chizhov and you with him. I'll give him a hiding, that I will. He was laughing at me."
"We'll give Chizhov a hiding. More likely he'll give you one. You're a fool, that's what you are."
"Not Chizhov, not Chizhov, you spiteful, mischievous woman. I'll give the boy a hiding. Catch him, catch him, he's laughing at me."
The women guffawed, but Kolya was by now a long way off, marching along with a triumphant air. Smurov walked beside him, looking round at the shouting group far behind. He too was in high spirits, though he was still afraid of getting into some scrape in Kolya's company.
"What Sabaneyev did you mean?"
he asked Kolya, foreseeing what his answer would be.
"How do I know? Now there'll be a hubbub among them all day. I like to stir up fools in every class of society.
There's another blockhead, that peasant there. You know, they say there's no one stupider than a stupid Frenchman, but his stupid Russian shows it in his face just as much. Can't you see it all over his face that he's a fool, that peasant, eh?"
"Let him alone, Kolya, let's go on.
Nothing could stop me now I'm once off. Hey, good morning, peasant."
A sturdy-looking peasant with a round, simple face and grizzled beard, who was walking by, raised his head and looked at the boy. He seemed not quite sober.
"Good morning, if you're not laughing at me," he said deliberately in reply.
"And if I am," laughed Kolya.
"Well, a joke's a joke. Laugh away, I don't mind. There's no harm in a joke."
"I beg your pardon, brother, it was a joke."
"Well, God forgive you."
"Do you forgive me too?"
"I quite forgive you. Go along."
"I say, you seem a clever peasant."
"Cleverer than you,"
the peasant answered unexpectedly with the same gravity.
"I doubt it," said Kolya, somewhat taken aback.
"It's true, though."
"Perhaps it is."
"It is, brother."
"Goodbye, peasant."
"Goodbye."
"There are all sorts of peasants," Kolya observed to Smurov, after a brief silence.
"How could I tell? I'd hit on a clever one.
I'm always ready to recognize intelligence in the peasantry. In the distance, the cathedral clock struck 11:30. The boys made haste, and they walked as far as Captain Snegiryov's lodging, a considerable distance, quickly and almost in silence. 20 paces from the house, Kolya stopped and told Smurov to go on ahead, and asked Karamazov to come out to him.
"One must sniff round a bit first," he observed to Smurov. "I ask him to come out," Smurov protested. "You go in. They'll be awfully glad to see you. What's the sense of making friends in the frost out here?"
"I know why I want to see him out here in the frost,"
Kolya cut him short, in the despotic tone he was fond of adopting with small boys.
And Smurov ran to do his bidding. Chapter 4. The Lost Dog. Kolya leaned against the fence with an air of dignity, waiting for Alyosha to appear. Yes, he had long wanted to meet him. He'd heard a great deal about him from the boys, but hitherto he'd always maintained an appearance of disdainful indifference when he was mentioned, and he had even criticized what he heard about Alyosha. But secretly he had a great longing to make his acquaintance. There was something sympathetic and attractive in all he was told about Alyosha. So the present moment was important. To begin with, he had to show himself at his best, to show his independence. "Or he'll think of me as 13 and take me for a boy, like the rest of them. And what are these boys to him? I shall ask him when I get to know him. It's a pity I'm so short, though. Tuzikov is younger than I am, yet he is half a head taller. But I have a clever face. I'm not good-looking. I know I'm hideous, but I've a clever face. I mustn't talk too freely. If I fall into his arms all at once, he may think, 'Oh, phew, how horrible, if he should think!'" Such were the thoughts that excited Kolya while he was doing his utmost to assume the most independent air. What distressed him most was his being so short. He did not mind so much his hideous face as being so short. On the wall, in a corner at home, he had the year before made a pencil mark to show his height, and every 2 months since he anxiously measured himself against it to see how much he'd gained. But alas, he grew very slowly, and this sometimes reduced him almost to despair. His face was in reality by no means hideous. On the contrary, it was rather attractive, with a fair, pale skin, freckled. His small, lively grey eyes had a fearless look and often glowed with feeling. He had rather high cheekbones, small, very red, but very thick lips. His nose was small and unmistakably turned up. "I've a regular pug nose, a regular pug nose," Kolya used to mutter to himself when he looked in the looking-glass, and he always left it with indignation. "But perhaps I haven't got a clever face," he sometimes thought, doubtful even of that. But it must not be supposed that his mind was preoccupied with his face and his height. On the contrary, however bitter the moments before the looking-glass were to him, he quickly forgot them, and forgot them for a long time, abandoning himself entirely to ideas and to real life, as he formulated it to himself. Alyosha came out quickly and hastened up to Kolya. Before he reached him, Kolya could see that he looked delighted.
"Can he be so glad to see me?"
Kolya wondered, feeling pleased. We may note here in passing that Alyosha's appearance had undergone a complete change since we saw him last. He had abandoned his cassock and was wearing now a well-cut coat, a soft, round hat, and his hair had been cropped short. All this was very becoming to him, and he looked quite handsome. His charming face always had a good-humoured expression, but there was a gentleness and serenity in his good humour. To Kolya's surprise, Alyosha came out to him just as he was, without an overcoat. He had evidently come in haste. He held out his hand to Kolya at once.
"Here you are at last. How anxious we've been to see you." "There were reasons which you shall note directly. Anyway, I'm glad to make your acquaintance. I've long been hoping for an opportunity, and have heard a great deal about you,"
Kolya muttered a little breathless.
"We should have met anyway. I've heard a great deal about you, too. But you've been a long time coming here. Tell me, how are things going?"
"Ilusha is very ill. He is certainly dying."
"How awful! You must admit that medicine is a fraud, Karamazov," cried Kolya warmly. "Ilusha has mentioned you often, very often, even in his sleep, in delirium, you know. One can see that you used to be very, very dear to him.
before the incident with the knife. Then there's another reason. Tell me, is that your dog?
Yes, Perez von,
not Zhuchka.
Alyosha looked at Kolya with eyes full of pity. Is she lost forever?
I know you would all like it to be Zhuchka. I've heard all about it.
Kolya smiled mysteriously.
Listen, Karamazov, I'll tell you all about it. That's what I came for. That's what I asked you to come out here for, to explain the whole episode to you before we go in.
He began with animation.
You see, Karamazov, Ilusha came into the preparatory class last spring. Well, you know what our preparatory class is. A lot of small boys. They began teasing Ilusha at once. I'm two classes higher up, and of course I only look on at them from a distance. I saw the boy was weak and small, but he wouldn't give in to them. He fought with them. I saw he was proud, and his eyes were full of fire. I like children like that, and they teased him all the more. The worst of it was he was horribly dressed at the time. His breeches were too small for him, and there were holes in his boots. They worried him about it. They jeered at him. That I can't stand. I stood up for him at once and gave it to them hot. I beat them, but they adore me, do you know, Karamazov?
Kolya boasted impulsively.
But I'm always fond of children. I've two chickens on my hands at home now. That's what detained me today. So they left off beating Ilusha, and I took him under my protection. I saw the boy was proud. I tell you that, the boy was proud. But in the end, he became slavishly devoted to me. He did my slightest bidding, obeyed me as though I were God, tried to copy me. In the intervals between the classes, he used to run to me at once, and I'd go about with him. On Sundays, too. They always laugh when an older boy makes friends with a younger one like that. But that's a prejudice. If it's my fancy, that's enough. I'm teaching him, developing him. Why shouldn't I develop him if I like him? Here, you, Karamazov, have taken up with all these nestlings. I see you want to influence the younger generation, to develop them, to be of use to them, and I assure you this trait in your character, which I knew by hearsay, abstracted me more than anything. Let us get to the point, though. I noticed that there was a sort of softness and sentimentality coming over the boy, and you know I have a positive hatred of this sheepish sentimentality, and I've had it from a baby. There were contradictions in him, too. He was proud, but he was slavishly devoted to me, and yet all at once his eyes would flush, and he'd refuse to agree with me. He'd argue, fly into a rage. I used sometimes to propound certain ideas. I could see that it was not so much that he disagreed with the idea, but that he was simply rebelling against me, because I was cool in responding to his endearments. And so, in order to train him properly, the tenderer he was, the colder I became. I did it on purpose. That was my idea. My object was to form his character, to lick him into shape, to make a man of him. And besides, no doubt you understand me at a word. Suddenly I noticed for 3 days in succession he was downcast and dejected, not because of my coldness, but for something else, something more important. I wonder what the tragedy was. I've pumped him and found out that he had somehow got to know Smerdyakov, who was footman to your late father. It was before his death, of course. And he taught the little fool a silly trick. That is, a brutal, nasty trick. He told him to take a piece of bread, to stick a pin in it, and throw it to one of those hungry dogs who snap up anything without biting it, and then to watch and see what would happen. So they prepared a piece of bread like that and threw it to Zhuchka, that shaggy dog there's been such a fuss about. The people of the house it belonged to never fed it at all, though it barked all day. Do you like that stupid barking, Karamazov? I can't stand it. So it rushed at the bread, swallowed it, and began to squeal. It turned round and round and ran away, squealing as it ran out of sight. That was Ilusha's own account of it. He confessed it to me and cried bitterly. He hugged me, shaking all over. He kept on repeating, "He ran away squealing." The sight of that haunted him. He was tormented by remorse, I could see that. I took it seriously. I determined to give him a lesson for other things as well. So I must confess I wasn't quite straightforward, and pretended to be more indignant perhaps than I was. "You've done a nasty thing," I said. "You are a scoundrel. I won't tell of it, of course, but I shall have nothing more to do with you for a time. I'll think it over and let you know through Smurov." That's the boy who's just come with me. He's always ready to do anything for me. Whether I will have anything to do with you in the future, or whether I give you up for good as a scoundrel."
He was tremendously upset. I must own I felt I'd gone too far as I spoke, but there was no help for it. I did what I thought best at the time. A day or two after, I sent Smoor off to tell him that I'd not speak to him again. That's what we call it when two schoolfellows refuse to have anything more to do with one another. Secretly, I only meant to send him to Coventry for a few days, and then, if I saw signs of repentance, to hold out my hand to him again. That was my intention. But what do you think happened? He heard Smurov's message. His eyes flashed. "Tell Cressock him from me," he cried, "that I'll throw bread with pins to all the dogs, all of them. So he's going in for a little temper. We must smoke it out of him." And I began to treat him with contempt. Whenever I met him, I turned away or smiled sarcastically. And just then that affair with his father happened. You remember? You must realize that he was fearfully worked up by what had happened already. The boys, seeing I'd given him up, set on him and taunted him, shouting, "Wisp of tow, wisp of tow." And he had soon regular skirmishes with them, which I'm very sorry for. They seem to have given him one very bad beating. One day he flew at them all as they were coming out of school. I stood a few yards off looking on, and I swear I don't remember that I laughed. It was quite the other way. I felt awfully sorry for him. In another minute I would have run up to take his part. But he suddenly met my eyes. I don't know what he fancied, but he pulled out a penknife, rushed at me and struck at my thigh, here in my right leg. I didn't move. I don't mind owning I am plucky sometimes, Karamazov. I simply looked at him contemptuously, as though to say, "This is how you repay all my kindness. Do it again if you like, I'm at your service." But he didn't stab me again. He broke down. He was frightened at what he'd done. He threw away the knife, burst out crying, and ran away. I did not sneak on him, of course, and I made them all keep quiet, so it shouldn't come to the ears of the masters. I didn't even tell my mother till it had healed up, and the wound was a mere scratch. And then I heard that the same day he'd been throwing stones and had bitten your finger. But you understand now what a state he was in. Well, it can't be helped. It was stupid of me not to come and forgive him, that is, to make it up with him. When he was taken ill, I'm sorry for it now. But I had a special reason. So now I've told you all about it, but I'm afraid it was stupid of me.
"Oh, what a pity," exclaimed Alyosha with feeling, "that I didn't know before what terms you were on with him, or I'd have come to you long ago to beg you to go to him with me. Would you believe it, when he was feverish, he talked about you in delirium. I didn't know how much you were to him. And you really not succeeded in finding that dog? His father and the boys have been hunting all over the town for it. Would you believe it, since he's been ill, I've three times heard him repeat with tears, 'It's because I killed Zhutchka, father, that I'm ill now. God is punishing me for it.' He can't get that idea out of his head. And if the dog were found and proved to be alive, one might also fancy the joy would cure him. We've all rested our hopes on you.
Tell me, what made you hope I should be the one to find him?"
Kolya asked with great curiosity.
"Why did you reckon on me rather than anyone else?"
"There was a report that you were looking for the dog, and that you would bring it when you'd found it. Smurov said something of the sort. We've all been trying to persuade Ilusha that the dog is alive, that it's been seen. The boys brought him a live hare. He just looked at it with a faint smile and asked them to set it free in the fields, and so we did. His father has just this moment come back, bringing him a mastiff pup, hoping to comfort him with that. But I think it only makes it worse."
"Tell me, Karamazov, what sort of man is the father? I know him, but what do you make of him? A mountebank? A buffoon?"
"Oh, no, there are people of deep feeling who have been somehow crushed. Buffoonery in them is a form of resentful irony against those to whom they daren't speak the truth, from having been for years humiliated and intimidated by them. Believe me, Krasotkin, that sort of buffoonery is sometimes tragic in the extreme. His whole life is now centered in Ilusha, and if Ilusha dies, he will either go mad with grief or kill himself. I feel almost certain of that when I look at him now."
"I understand you, Karamazov. I see you understand human nature,"
Kolya added with feeling. "And as soon as I saw you with a dog, I thought it was Zhutchka you were bringing."
"Wait a bit, Karamazov. Perhaps we shall find it yet. But this is Perezvon. I'll let him go in now, and perhaps it'll amuse Ilusha more than the mastiff pup." "Wait a bit, Karamazov. You will know something in a minute.
"But, I say, I'm keeping you here," Kolya cried suddenly. "You've no overcoat on in this bitter cold. You see what an egoist I am." "Oh, we're all egoists, Karamazov." "Don't trouble. It is cold, but I don't often catch cold. Let us go in, though, and by the way, what is your name? I know you're called Kolya, but what else?"
Nikolai Ivanovich Krasotkin, or, as they say in official documents, Krasotkin's son."
Kolya laughed for some reason, but added suddenly,
"Of course I hate my name, Nikolai."
"Why so?"
"It's so trivial, so ordinary."
"You're 13?" asked Alyosha.
"No, 14. Well, that is, I shall be 14 very soon, in a fortnight.
I'll confess one weakness of mine, Karamazov, just to you since it's our first meeting, so that you may understand my character at once. I hate being asked my age, more than that, and in fact, there's a libelous story going about me that last week I played robbers with the preparatory boys. It's a fact that I did play with them, but it's a perfect libel to say I did it for my own amusement.
I have reasons for believing that you've heard the story, but I wasn't playing for my own amusement. It was for the sake of the children, because they couldn't think of anything to do by themselves. But they've always got some silly tale. This is an awful town for gossip, I can tell you."
"But what if you had been playing for your own amusement? What's the harm?"
"Come, I say, for my own amusement. You don't play horses, do you?"
"But you must look at it like this," said Alyosha, smiling. "Grown-up people go to the theatre, and there the adventures of all sorts of heroes are represented. Sometimes there are robbers and battles, too. And isn't that just the same thing, in a different form, of course? And young people's games of soldiers or robbers in their playtime are also art in its first stage. You know, they spring from the growing artistic instincts of the young, and sometimes these games are much better than performances in the theatre. The only difference is that people go there to look at actors, while in these games the young people are the actors themselves. But that's only natural."
"You think so? Is that your idea?"
Kolya looked at him intently.
"Oh, you know, that's rather an interesting view. When I go home, I'll think it over. I'll admit I thought I might learn something from you. I've come to learn of you, Karamazov,"
Kolya concluded, in a voice full of spontaneous feeling.
"And I of you,"
said Alyosha, smiling and pressing his hand. Kolya was much pleased with Alyosha. What struck him most was that he treated him exactly like an equal, and that he talked to him just as if he were quite grown up.
"I'll show you something directly, Karamazov. It's a theatrical performance, too," he said, laughing nervously. "That's why I've come."
"Let us go first to the people of the house, on the left. All the boys leave their coats in there because the room is small and hot."
"Oh, I'm only coming in for a minute. I'll keep on my overcoat. Perezvon will stay here in the passage and be dead. Ici, Perezvon, lie down and be dead. You see how he's dead? I'll go in first and explore, then I'll whistle to him when I think fit, and you'll see he'll dash in like mad. Only Smurov must not forget to open the door at the moment. I'll arrange it all and you'll see something."
Chapter 5. By Ilusha's Bedside. The room inhabited by the family of the retired Captain Snegiryov is already familiar to the reader. It was close and crowded at that moment with a number of visitors. Several boys were sitting with Ilusha, and though all of them, like Smurov, were prepared to deny that it was Alyosha who had brought them and reconciled them with Ilusha, it was really the fact. All the art he had used had been to take them, one by one, to Ilusha without sheepish sentimentality, appearing to do so casually and without design. It was a great consolation to Ilusha in his suffering. He was greatly touched by seeing the almost tender affection and sympathy shown him by these boys, who had been his enemies. Krasotkin was the only one missing, and his absence was a heavy load on Ilusha's heart. Perhaps the bitterest of all his bitter memories was his stabbing Krasotkin, who had been his one friend and protector. Clever little Smurov, who was the first to make it up with Ilusha, thought it was so. But when Smurov hinted to Krasotkin that Alyosha wanted to come and see him about something, the latter cut him short, bidding Smurov tell Karamazov at once that he knew best what to do, that he wanted no one's advice, and that if he went to see Ilusha, He would choose his own time, for he had his own reasons. That was a fortnight before this Sunday. That was why Alyosha had not been to see him, as he'd meant to. But though he waited, he sent Smurov to him twice again. Both times Krasotkin met him with a curt, impatient refusal, sending Alyosha a message not to bother him any more, that if he came himself, he, Krasotkin, would not go to Alyosha at all. Up to the very last day, Smurov did not know that Kolya meant to go to Alyosha that morning, and only the evening before, as he parted from Smurov, Kolya abruptly told him to wait at home for him next morning, for he would go with him to the Snegiryovs, but warned him on no account to say he was coming, as he wanted to drop in casually. Smurov obeyed. Smurov's fancy that Kolya would bring back the lost dog was based on the words Kolya had dropped that they must be asses not to find the dog if it was alive. When Smurov, waiting for an opportunity, timidly hinted at his guess about the dog, Krasotkin flew into a violent rage. "I'm not such an ass as to go hunting about the town for other people's dogs when I've got a dog of my own. And how can you imagine a dog could be alive after swallowing a pin? Sheepish sentimentality, that's what it is." For the last fortnight, Ilusha had not left his little bed under the icons in the corner. He had not been to school since the day he met Alyosha and bit his finger. He was taken ill the same day, though for a month afterwards he was sometimes able to get up and walk about the room and passage. But latterly he had become so weak that he could not move without help from his father. His father was terribly concerned about him. He even gave up drinking and was almost crazy with terror that his boy would die. And often, especially after leading him round the room on his arm and putting him back to bed, he would run to a dark corner in the passage, and leaning his head against the wall, he would break into paroxysms of violent weeping, stifling his sobs that they might not be heard by Ilusha. Returning to the room, he would usually begin doing something to amuse and comfort his precious boy. He would tell him stories, funny anecdotes, or would mimic comic people he had happened to meet, even imitate the howls and cries of animals. But Ilusha could not bear to see his father fooling and playing the buffoon. Though the boy tried not to show how he disliked it, he saw with an aching heart that his father was an object of contempt, and he was continually haunted by the memory of the wisp of tow and that terrible day. Nina, Ilusha's gentle, crippled sister, did not like her father's buffoonery either. Varvara had been gone for some time past to Petersburg to study at the university. But the half-imbecile mother was greatly diverted and laughed heartily when her husband began capering about or performing something. It was the only way she could be amused. All the rest of the time she was grumbling and complaining that now everyone had forgotten her, that no one treated her with respect, that she was slighted and so on. But during the last few days she had completely changed. She began looking constantly at Ilusha's bed in the corner and seemed lost in thought. She was more silent, quieter, and if she cried quietly so as not to be heard. The captain noticed the change in her with mournful perplexity. The boys' visits at first only angered her, but later on their merry shouts and stories began to divert her, and at last she liked them so much that, if the boys had given up coming, she would have felt dreary without them. When the children told some story or played a game, she laughed and clapped her hands. She called some of them to her and kissed them. She was particularly fond of Smurov. As for the captain, the presence in his room of the children, who came to cheer up Ilusha, filled his heart from the first with ecstatic joy. He even hoped that Ilusha would now get over his depression, and that that would hasten his recovery. In spite of his alarm about Ilusha, he had not, till lately, felt one minute's doubt of his boy's ultimate recovery. He met his little visitors with homage, waited upon them hand and foot. He was ready to be their horse, and even began letting them ride on his back. But Ilusha did not like the game, and it was given up. He began buying little things for them, gingerbread and nuts, gave them tea, and cut them sandwiches. It must be noted that all this time he had plenty of money. He had taken the 200 rubles from Katerina Ivanovna, just as Alyosha had predicted he would. And afterwards, Katerina Ivanovna, learning more about their circumstances and Ilusha's illness, visited them herself, made the acquaintance of the family, and succeeded in fascinating the half-imbecile mother. Since then she'd been lavish in helping them, and the captain, terror-stricken at the thought that his boy might be dying, forgot his pride and humbly accepted her assistance. All this time Dr. Herzenstube, who was called in by Katerina Ivanovna, came punctually every other day, but little was gained by his visits, and he dosed the invalid mercilessly. But on that Sunday morning a new doctor was expected, who had come from Moscow, where he had a great reputation. Katerina Ivanovna had sent for him from Moscow at great expense, not expressly for Ilusha, but for another object of which more will be said in its place hereafter. But, as he had come, she'd asked him to see Ilusha as well, and the captain had been told to expect him. He hadn't the slightest idea that Kolya Krasotkin was coming, though he had long wished for a visit from the boy for whom Ilusha was fretting. At the moment when Krasotkin opened the door and came into the room, the captain and all the boys were round Ilusha's bed, looking at a tiny mastiff pup, which had only been born the day before, though the captain had bespoken it a week ago to comfort and amuse Ilusha, who was still fretting over the lost and probably dead Zhuchka. Ilusha, who had heard 3 days before that he was to be presented with a puppy, not an ordinary puppy, but a pedigree mastiff, a very important point, of course, tried, from delicacy of feeling, to pretend that he was pleased. But his father and the boys could not help seeing that the puppy only served to recall to his little heart the thought of the unhappy dog he'd killed. The puppy lay beside him, feebly moving, and he, smiling sadly, stroked it with his thin, pale, wasted hand. Clearly he liked the puppy, but it wasn't Zhuchka. If he could have had Zhuchka and the puppy too, then he would have been completely happy.
"Krasotkin!" cried one of the boys suddenly. He was the first to see him come in.
Krasotkin's entrance made a general sensation. The boys moved away and stood on each side of the bed, so that he could get a full view of Ilusha. The captain ran eagerly to meet Kolya.
"Please come in. You're welcome," he said hurriedly. "Ilusha, Mr. Krasotkin has come to see you."
But Krasotkin, shaking hands with him hurriedly, instantly showed his complete knowledge of the manners of good society. He turned first to the captain's wife, sitting in her armchair, who was very ill-humoured at the moment, and was grumbling that the boys stood between her and Ilusha's bed, and did not let her see the new puppy. With the greatest courtesy he made her a bow, scraping his foot, and then turning to Nina, he made her, as the only other lady present, a similar bow. This polite behaviour made an extremely favourable impression on the deranged lady.
"There, you can see at once he's a young man that has been well brought up," she commented aloud, throwing up her hands. "But as for our other visitors, they come in one on the top of another."
"How do you mean, Mama, one on the top of another? How is that?"
muttered the captain affectionately, though a little anxious on her account.
"That's how they ride in. They get on each other's shoulders in the passage and prance in like that on a respectable family. Strange sort of visitors."
"But who's come in like that, Mama?"
"Why, that boy came in riding on that one's back and this one on that one's."
Kolya was already by Ilusha's bedside. The sick boy turned visibly paler. He raised himself in the bed and looked intently at Kolya. Kolya had not seen his little friend for 2 months, and he was overwhelmed at the sight of him. He had never imagined that he would see such a wasted yellow face, such enormous, feverishly glowing eyes, and such thin little hands. He saw with grieved surprise Ilusha's rapid, hard breathing and dry lips. He stepped close to him, held out his hand, and almost overwhelmed he said,
"Well, old man, how are you?"
But his voice failed him. He couldn't achieve an appearance of ease. His face suddenly twitched, and the corners of his mouth quivered. Ilusha smiled a pitiful little smile, still unable to utter a word. Something moved Kolya to raise his hand and pass it over Ilusha's hair.
"Never mind,"
he murmured softly to him to cheer him up, or perhaps not knowing why he said it. For a minute they were silent again.
"Hello, so you've got a new puppy?"
Kolya said suddenly, in a most callous voice.
"Yes."
answered Ilusha in a long whisper, gasping for breath. "A black nose, that means he'll be fierce. A good house dog," Kolya observed gravely and stolidly, as if the only thing he cared about was the puppy and its black nose. But in reality he still had to do his utmost to control his feelings, not to burst out crying like a child. And do what he would, he could not control it. "When it grows up, you'll have to keep it on the chain, I'm sure." "He'll be a huge dog," cried one of the boys. "Of course he will. A mastiff. Large. Like this. As big as a calf," shouted several voices.
"As big as a calf, as a real calf," chimed in the captain. "I got one like that on purpose, one of the fiercest breed, and his parents are huge and very fierce. They stand as high as this from the floor. Sit down here on Ilusha's bed, or here on the bench. You're welcome. We've been hoping to see you a long time. You were so kind as to come with Alexei Fyodorovich?"
Krasotkin sat on the edge of the bed, at Ilusha's feet. Though he had perhaps prepared a free and easy opening for the conversation on his way, now he completely lost the thread of it.
No, I came with Perezvon. I've got a dog now called Perezvon, a Slavonic name. He's out there. If I whistle, he'll run in. I've brought a dog, too," he said, addressing Ilusha all at once. "Do you remember Zhuchka, old man?" He suddenly fired the question at him.
Ilusha's little face quivered. He looked with an agonized expression at Kolya. Alyosha, standing at the door, frowned and signed to Kolya not to speak of Zhuchka. But he did not, or would not notice.
"Where is Zhuchka?"
Ilusha asked in a broken voice.
"Oh, well, my boy, your Zhuchka's lost and done for."
Ilusha did not speak, but he fixed an intent gaze once more on Kolya. Alyosha, catching Kolya's eye, signed to him vigorously again, but he turned away his eyes, pretending not to have noticed.
"It must have run away and died somewhere. Must have died after a meal like that,"
Kolya pronounced pitilessly, though he seemed a little breathless.
"But I've got a dog, Perezvon, a Slavonic name. I brought him to show you."
"I don't want him," said Ilusha suddenly.
No, you really must see him. It'll amuse you. I brought him on purpose. He's the same sort of shaggy dog.
You allow me to call in my dog, madame?"
He suddenly addressed Madame Snegiryov with inexplicable excitement in his manner.
"I don't want him. I don't want him," cried Ilusha with a mournful break in his voice.
There was a reproachful light in his eyes.
"You'd better."
The captain started up from the chest by the wall on which he had just sat down.
"You'd better, another time,"
he muttered. But Kolya could not be restrained. He hurriedly shouted to Smurov, "Open the door!" And as soon as it was open, he blew his whistle. Perezvon dashed headlong into the room.
"Jump, Perezvon, beg, beg!"
shouted Kolya, jumping up, and the dog stood erect on his hind legs by Ilusha's bedside.
What followed was a surprise to everyone. Ilusha started, lurched violently forward, bent over Perezvon, and gazed at him, faint with suspense.
"It's Zhuchka!"
he cried suddenly in a voice breaking with joy and suffering.
"And who did you think it was?"
Krasotkin shouted with all his might, in a ringing, happy voice, and bending down he seized the dog and lifted him up to Ilusha.
"Look, old man, you see, blind in one eye, and the left ear is torn, just the marks you described to me. It was by that I found him. I found him directly. He did not belong to anyone," he explained, turning quickly to the captain, to his wife, to Alyosha, and then again to Ilusha.
"He used to live in the Fedotovs' backyard. Though he made his home there, they did not feed him. He was a stray dog that had run away from the village. I found him. You see, old man, he couldn't have swallowed what you gave him. If he had, he must have died. He must have. So he must have spat it out since he's alive.
You did not see him do it, but the pin pricked his tongue. That's why he squealed. He ran away squealing, and you thought he'd swallowed it. He might well squeal, because the skin of dogs' mouths is so tender. Tenderer than in men. Much tenderer,"
Kolya cried impetuously, his face glowing and radiant with delight.
Ilusha could not speak.
White as a sheet, he gazed open-mouthed at Kolya, with his great eyes almost starting out of his head. And if Krasotkin, who had no suspicion of it, had known what a disastrous and fatal effect such a moment might have on the sick child's health, nothing would have induced him to play such a trick on him. but Alyosha was perhaps the only person in the room who realized it. As for the captain, he behaved like a small child.
"Zhuchka, it's Zhuchka," he cried in a blissful voice. "Ilusha, this is Zhuchka, your Zhuchka. Mama, this is Zhuchka."
He was almost weeping.
"And I never guessed," cried Smurov regretfully. "Bravo, Krasotkin. I said he'd find the dog, and here he's found him."
"Here he's found him," another boy repeated gleefully.
"Krasotkin's a brick," cried a third voice. "He's a brick, he's a brick," cried the other boys, and they began clapping.
"Wait, wait."
Krasotkin did his utmost to shout above them all.
"I'll tell you how it happened. That's the whole point. I found him, I took him home, and hid him at once. I kept him locked up at home and did not show him to anyone till today. Only Smurov had known for the last fortnight, but I assured him this dog was called Perezvon, and he did not guess. And meanwhile I taught the dog all sorts of tricks. You should only see all the things he can do. I trained him so as to bring you a well-trained dog in good condition, old man, so as to be able to say to you, 'See, old man, what a fine dog your Zhuchka is now. Haven't you a bit of meat? He'll show you a trick that will make you die with laughing. A piece of meat, haven't you got any?'"
The captain ran across the passage to the landlady where their cooking was done. Not to lose precious time, Kolya, in desperate haste, shouted to Perezvon, "Dead!" and the dog immediately turned round and lay on his back with its four paws in the air. The boys laughed. Ilusha looked on with the same suffering smile, but the person most delighted with the dog's performance was Mama. She laughed at the dog and began snapping her fingers and calling it, "Perezvon! Perezvon!"
"Nothing will make him get up, nothing!"
Kolya cried triumphantly, proud of his success. "He won't move for all the shouting in the world, but if I call to him, he'll jump up in a minute. Easy, Perezvon!" The dog leapt up and bounded about, whining with delight. The captain ran back with a piece of cooked beef.
"Is it hot?"
Kolya inquired hurriedly, with a businesslike air, taking the meat.
"Dogs don't like hot things." "No, it's all right. Look, everybody, look. Ilusha, look, old man. Why aren't you looking? He does not look at him now I've brought him."
The new trick consisted in making the dog stand motionless with his nose out and putting a tempting morsel of meat just on his nose. The luckless dog had to stand without moving, with the meat on his nose, as long as his master chose to keep his without a movement. Perhaps for half an hour. But he kept Perezvon only for a brief moment.
"Paid for,"
cried Kolya, and the meat passed in a flash from the dog's nose to his mouth. The audience, of course, expressed enthusiasm and surprise.
"Can you really have put off coming all this time, simply to train the dog?"
exclaimed Alyosha with an involuntary note of reproach in his voice.
"Simply for that," answered Kolya with perfect simplicity. "I wanted to show him in all his glory."
"Perezvon, Perezvon,"
called Ilusha suddenly, snapping his thin fingers and beckoning to the dog.
"What is it? Let him jump up in the bed. Ici, Perezvon!"
Kolya slapped the bed and Perezvon darted up by Ilusha. The boy threw both arms round his head, and Perezvon instantly licked his cheek. Ilusha crept close to him, stretched himself out in bed, and hid his face in the dog's shaggy coat.
"Dear, dear!" kept exclaming the captain.
Kolya sat down again on the edge of the bed.
"Ilusha, I can show you another trick. I brought you a little cannon. You remember I told you about it before and you said how much you liked to see it. Well, here, I've brought it to you."
And Kolya hurriedly pulled out of his satchel the little bronze cannon. He hurried because he was happy himself. Another time he would have waited till the sensation made by Perezvon had passed off. Now he hurried on regardless of all consideration.
"You're all happy now," he felt, "so here's something to make you happier."
He was perfectly enchanted himself.
"I've been coveting this thing for a long while. It's for you, old man. It's for you. It belonged to Morozov. It was no use to him. He had it from his brother. I swapped a book from father's bookcase for it, A Kinsman of Mahomet or Salutary Folly, a scandalous book published in Moscow 100 years ago, before they had any censorship. And Morozov has a taste for such things. He was grateful to me, too."
Kolya held the cannon in his hand so that all could see and admire it. Ilusha raised himself, and with his right arm still round the dog, he gazed enchanted at the toy. The sensation was even greater when Collier announced that he had gunpowder too, and that it could be fired off at once, if it won't alarm the ladies. Mama immediately asked to look at the toy closer, and her request was granted. She was much pleased with the little bronze cannon on wheels, and began rolling it to and fro on her lap. She readily gave permission for the cannon to be fired, without any idea of what she'd been asked. Collier showed the powder and the shot. The captain, as a military man, undertook to load it, putting in a minute quantity of powder. He asked that the shot might be put off till another time. The cannon was put on the floor, aiming towards an empty part of the room. Three grains of powder were thrust into the touch hole, and a match was put to it. A magnificent explosion followed. Mama was startled, but at once laughed with delight. The boys gazed in speechless triumph. But the captain, looking at Ilusha, was more enchanted than any of them. Collier picked up the cannon and immediately presented it to Ilusha, together with the powder and the shot. "I got it for you. For you! I've been keeping it for you a long time," he repeated once more in his delight. "Oh, give it to me. No, give me the cannon," Mama began begging like a little child. Her face showed a piteous fear that she would not get it. Collier was disconcerted. The captain fidgeted uneasily. "Mama, Mama," he ran to her. "The cannon's yours, of course, but let Ilusha have it because it's a present to him. But it's just as good as yours. Ilusha will always let you play with it. It shall belong to both of you. Both of you."
"No, I don't want it to belong to both of us. I want it to be mine altogether, not Ilusha's," persisted Mama on the point of tears. "Take it, Mother. Here, keep it," Ilusha cried. "Krasotkin, may I give it to my mother?"
He turned to Krasotkin with an imploring face, as though he were afraid he might be offended at his giving his present to someone else.
"Of course you may,"
Krasotkin assented heartily. And taking the cannon from Ilusha, he handed it himself to Mama with a polite bow. She was so touched that she cried.
"Ilusha, darling, he's the one who loves his Mama," she said tenderly, and at once began wheeling the cannon to and fro on her lap again.
"Mama, let me kiss your hand." The captain darted up to her at once and did so.
"And I never saw such a charming fellow as this nice boy," said the grateful lady, pointing to Krasotkin. "And I'll bring you as much powder as you like, Ilusha. We make the powder ourselves now. Borovikov found out how it's made. 24 parts of saltpeter, 10 of sulphur, and 6 of birchwood charcoal. It's all pounded together, mixed into a paste with water, and rubbed through a tammy sieve. That's how it's done."
"Smurov told me about your powder, and your father says it's not real gunpowder," responded Ilusha.
"Not real?" Collier flushed. "It burns?
I don't know, of course." "No, I didn't mean that," put in the captain with a guilty face. "I only said that real powder is not made like that. But that's nothing. It can be made so."
"I don't know. You know best. We lighted some in a pomatum pot. It burned splendidly. It all burnt away, leaving only a tiny ash. But that was only the paste, and if you rub it through... But of course you know best. I don't know. And Bulkin's father thrashed him on account of our powder. Did you hear?" He turned to Ilusha.
"Yes," answered Ilusha.
He listened to Collier with immense interest and enjoyment.
"We'd prepared a whole bottle of it, and he used to keep it under his bed. His father saw it. He said it might explode, and thrashed him on the spot. He was going to make a complaint against me to the masters. He's not allowed to go about with me now. No one is allowed to go about with me now. Smurov is not allowed to either. I've got a bad name with everyone. They say I'm a desperate character."
Collier smiled scornfully. "It all began from what happened on the railway."
"Ah, we've heard of that exploit of yours, too," cried the captain. "How could you lie still on the line? Is it possible you weren't the least afraid, lying there under the train? Weren't you frightened?"
The captain was abject in his flattery of Collier.
"Not particularly," answered Collier carelessly. "What's blasted my reputation more than anything here was that cursed goose," he said, turning again to Ilusha.
But though he assumed an unconcerned air as he talked, he still could not control himself, and was continually missing the note he tried to keep up.
"Ah, I heard about the goose,"
Ilusha laughed, beaming all over.
They told me, but I didn't understand. Did they really take you to the court?
The most stupid, trivial affair. They made a mountain of a molehill, as they always do. Collier began carelessly. I was walking through the marketplace here one day, just when they'd driven in the geese. I stopped and looked at them. All at once a fellow, who's an errand boy at Plotnikov's,